Studio 360.
Leonardo da Vinci is known as one of the great painters of all time, and an inventor way ahead of his time, and a scientist and a visionary. But one part of his resume is always left out: theatrical prop and production design impresario. Back in the 1490s, Leonardo was hired to stage plays for the Duke of Milan. Kind of a day job for the painter of The Last Supper, but it turns out that if Leonardo never created those theatrical spectacles, the single most arresting visual aspect of that famous painting, the way Jesus and his disciples are all on one side of the table facing out, wouldn't have been there. That is only one of the, who knew, surprises that delighted me as I read Walter Isaacson's latest bestseller, Leonardo da Vinci. He joins us now from a studio in New Orleans, which is why he sounds a little echoey, to talk about the madcap show business part of Da Vinci's multifaceted genius life. Walter, my friend, welcome back to Studio 360.
Thanks, Kurt. Good to be back.
So who was hiring Leonardo to do all this work on stage design and making props and costumes?
The Medici family, Lorenzo de Medici, Lorenzo the Magnificent, is in charge of the city. And every week there were three or four great pageants or plays or things that happened at the court. And so sometimes it's a pageant or play. Sometimes it's a debate over anatomy. But that was the thing you got paid to do. You know, you didn't get paid to invent flying machines. You got paid to make props for the stage. And I think Leonardo loved it, too. It wasn't just he did it for the money. He loved the theater, and you just see all these drawings in his notebooks. One of the first drawing I think Leonardo does is a silver point of a beautiful, ornate helmets and costumes. And then you realize, well, that was done for a pageant for the visit of an important duke.
But, I mean, because he did produce these whole plays. Like, you talk about this one, The Feast of Paradise.
Yeah, A Feast of Paradise, and it's produced many times, and it has, you know, people coming up from Hades and flying down, and it has mechanical devices where the earth is opening up and people coming out of it. And so Leonardo designed the mechanisms and the machinery that move the scenery on the stage.
Was it like, let's say, when we saw Star Wars in 1977 and went, holy smoke, I've never seen that before?
I think they were awed by the mechanisms. He loved having things like having a stage that was two hemispheres and it would turn around mechanically in the middle of the performance, or a earth that would open up. I assume people were totally awed by it, not just like Star Wars, but the way you might have been awed as a child. I'm, you know, from New Orleans, growing up and watching a great Mardi Gras pageant, or even a, you know, Madonna concert, or, you know, Lady Gaga concert. They were into special effects.
In the notebooks, you talk about this sketch he made for a mechanical bird.
It's amazing how he does that prop of a mechanical bird for a theatrical pageant. And then he becomes interested in, well, how would I do this in reality? Leonardo always took his fantasies and his imagination and then tried to apply them in reality, which is why he then tries to make human-powered flying machines. And so we get an entire series of notebooks on the flight of birds, which he just studies exactly how each bird flaps a wing. He does exactly the breast muscles of the bird. And then he does a dissection of human muscles to see if they can do it. And all of these things come from trying to take that prop of a mechanical bird and seeing if he can make human-powered flight.
Right.
That helicopter, that famous drawing he has of what looks like an aerial screw, and everybody says it's the first helicopter. What surprised me is when I looked in the notebooks, it was part of the props to bring angels down from the rafters in a play. And at the very, very end of his life, it's almost poignant and sad, his very last drawing of a bird, you can see the stage wire there. And once again, he's doing it as a prop because he's been unable to create a human-powered flying machine.
Which is so great. So did all that work that Leonardo did in the theater influence how and what he did in terms of his most famous work, his paintings?
I think so. Even The Last Supper is done as a theatrical stage set. It's almost like, okay, everybody get on this side of the table if you want to be in the picture. Well, the place you would do that is on a stage where you tilt the table and it's angled and the scenery goes back and everybody's on one side of the table facing the audience. And that's why the walls of The Last Supper go in an artificial perspective way. And the light comes in from the window in a very theatrical way. And the gestures are theatrical. And it's even a drama. As you know, imagine Jesus saying, one of you shall betray me. It's almost a storyboard because you can see the motion and drama in his paintings, his drawings, and it all comes from his theater work.
Well, and he painted, including some of his most famous works, in public. He put on a show as a painter.
I do think he liked drama even when he was painting. And so when he's doing The Last Supper, people come to the refectory of that monastery and they're watching him do the painting. It's almost like a public display. And he's very dramatic about it. We have one of the accounts of one of the friars there of how Leonardo would come blowing in the afternoon and would stare at it for like a long period of time and then just put one brush stroke and then stare for a while, and then dash off.
One of my absolutely favorite scenes in your book is this amazing sort of Top Chef competition between Leonardo and Michelangelo, about which I had known nothing. They're hired to simultaneously paint battle scenes next to each other, essentially, in Florence. Why was this such a fraught episode?
Because they were great rivals, and Michelangelo was as reclusive and slightly, you know, a nastier guy, didn't have many friends. And, of course, Leonardo had his whole retinue and his boyfriend and everything else. So they would run across each other in the plazas of Florence, and there was a tension there. They would diss each other, and so the elders of Florence decide, well, let's make use of this competition, and they hire each of them, they commission each of them to do a battle scene on opposite walls in Florence of the council hall.
Well, and this Michelangelo versus Da Vinci smackdown in the cathedral is like a 1490 reality show. It's crazy.
It is. It's just like a TV reality show.
Yeah. No, you can't make it up. Earlier, you mentioned Leonardo's boyfriend. Like a few people in the theater and the arts these days, Leonardo was gleefully, openly gay. But as a student, as a young person reading about him, I never learned that.
I think that says more about our histories than it does about Leonardo. He was quite comfortable with his longtime partner, nicknamed Salai, and later another partner named Melzi. He was quite comfortable being gay. And a lot of people, the nickname for gay in some places back then was Florenza, meaning somebody from Florence. So
that fact was one of my favorite facts of this book.
Well, and that shows why the creativity, I mean, why is Florence the birthplace of the Renaissance? It's partly because they were tolerant. And so if you were a Michelangelo or a Leonardo da Vinci and you were gay, it didn't really bother other people. And, I think it bothered earlier writers about Leonardo. They tried to skirt the fact that he was gay. This is difficult to do if you read the notebooks because he's even talking about all the little gifts he's buying Salai or the expensive gifts he's buying and drawing, you know, wonderful red chalk drawings of Salai in the nude. It's part of who he was and he was comfortable with it.
And he dressed very extravagantly and flashily, right?
He loved pink and purple short tunics.
And who doesn't?
Yeah, you know, and he had long, curly, flowing hair. If you want to know what he looks like, just look at the Vitruvian Man, because that's him with the curly, flowing, blonde hair, the well-proportioned body. And he even, one of my favorite little things in the notebook, He comes up with a recipe for blonde hair dye. He really does care about his appearance.
And I now understand Leonardo DiCaprio is going to play this other Leonardo in an adaptation of your book and producing the movie. Did he get hooked personally and just say, Walter, I want your book and I'm going to play Leonardo? How did that happen?
Well, I don't know, since I don't know Mr. DiCaprio. But I do know that he has said that he was named after Leonardo da Vinci because his parents were at the Uffizi, I think looking at the Annunciation, when Leonardo was in the womb and started kicking. And his father said, well, we'll name him Leonardo. And they bought the rights to the book, and I hope they make it because Leonardo DiCaprio, who, as I say, I don't know, but he's somebody who's interested in nature, interested in the environment, interested in science, interested in painting and art.
And is beautiful looking.
Yeah, and just like Leonardo da Vinci.
So, Walter, you've been through this before. Einstein was turned into a 10-episode TV season on the Nat Geo channel, a series called Genius, with Ron Howard as the executive producer. Your Steve Jobs biography was turned into a feature film directed by Danny Boyle and written by Aaron Sorkin. When you sell the rights to your books, do you just cash those checks and hope for the best?
Yeah, I'm very hands-off because I know I don't know anything about making movies. I kind of get out of the way and hope they'll do a good job.
So when they make TV shows and movies out of your books, do you eagerly go and see them?
No. And what I don't get is how much license should you be able to take when you're doing a movie? Like in Selma, should you be able to say that Lyndon Johnson sent the Martin Luther King tapes to Coretta if that didn't happen?
Right. In the movie, an FBI tape reveals to Coretta King that her husband's unfaithful.
I never feel comfortable with the amount of literary license people tend to take when they're doing a historical book. Most of the time, I'm kind of turning to my wife and saying, wait, it didn't happen that way. And she says, you're not very good at watching movies.
Well, thanks for writing this. And especially, as I say, for imagining Da Vinci as this impresario, theatrical guy was really an aspect of him, a dimension of him I was completely clueless about. So thank you.
Thank you, Kurt.
Walter Isaacson's Leonardo da Vinci is still in bookstores.